For decades, the federal student loan program has paid private lenders and banks a subsidy for loans they make to college students. The Obama administration wants to bypass banks. It would have the federal government lend directly to students. Some schools have already switched to direct lending, and NPR's Claudio Sanchez explains why.
$8 billion worth of student loans dried up in the last 10 months of 2008 as some of the nation's biggest banks and state guarantors of student loans either scaled down or stopped making loans altogether. Across the country, students and their parents didn't know what was going on.
At the rate many lenders were leaving the program, how certain could that parent be that that lender might be there for them that year, but what would happen the following year?
Nobody knew, says Anna Griswold, director of financial aid at Penn State University. But at the time, she says, 40,000 students were in danger of losing access to federal loans. Eventually, other lenders stepped in, and most students got their money. But by then, says Griswold,
it was very clear and a no-brainer as to what made the most sense for us here at Penn State.
What Penn State did was switch from the Federal Family Education Loan Program, which depends heavily on private lenders, to the direct lending program run by the U.S. Department of Education. Penn State was not alone. In the last year, over 500 colleges have made that switch. For good reason, says Robert Shireman, Deputy Undersecretary of Education.
We can be sure that the families, the students who need loans, will have them available when they need the funds. And we won't have a last-minute problem of a lender pulling out because of something that's maybe happened in the stock market or in credit markets.
Reliability, says Anna Griswold, is the biggest difference now that Penn State is a direct lending institution. The switch, she says, was simple. For students, little has changed. The financial aid office certifies a student's eligibility for federal aid online, processes the application, and sends it to the U.S. Department of Education via a secure system online. But opponents of direct lending say the Penn State example does not address a bigger issue.
To me, it boils down to competition and choice.
John Dean is special counsel to the Consumer Bankers Association. He says about 2,000 private lenders and banks today participate in the federal student loan program. Replacing them with a single lender, the federal government, would destroy competition and choice. Besides, says Dean, colleges have had the option to switch to direct lending since 1994. So why have 8 out of 10 schools chosen not to?
They obviously think that the customer service is going to be better.
The Education Department's Robert Shireman disagrees. He says this is all about creating a more efficient, cheaper way of lending money to students.
We can't afford to spend the money for an institution to choose something that costs taxpayers more.
Shireman says once private lenders are out of the picture, the $8 to $10 billion in subsidies the government has been paying them will go back into federal aid for students. The House of Representatives has already voted in favor of direct lending. It'll soon come up for a vote in the Senate, where passage is less certain. But the administration is so confident it will pass, the Education Department has drawn up plans to issue all loans through the direct lending program beginning next summer. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
Up next, the Kids Science Challenge. Cool science projects for elementary school kids. All they have to do is dream up a problem that they want to solve with science. Kids get a little guidance on the categories because they've limited the categories, and it's easy. We don't want to choose everything. They can choose from bio-inspired design, detective science, or sports on Mars. Are you wondering how your kids can get involved? There is still plenty of time for them to enter, and my next guest is here to talk about it. I'm sure he's a well-known voice to you. Jim Metzner, executive producer of the Kids Science Challenge, is also Pulse of the Planet producer. Welcome to Science Friday, Jim.
Hi, Ira.
Good to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us about the history of this contest.
Well, we realized some years ago that we were reaching a lot of people on Pulse of the Planet, about 900,000 adults, 18 or plus over, but not many kids. And our country, as your listeners are probably well aware of, is not doing so great in the education, in the science education department, certainly not in the younger grades. And so we were trying to put together a program with the help of the National Science Foundation that would turn kids onto science and just say that science is not only meaningful, it's interesting, it's fun.
Mm-hmm. And so what does it entail to enter the contest here?
Well, you've got to be a third to sixth grader.
Yeah.
And you can enter individually or you can enter in a team. A lot of kids enter in after-school groups. We work with 4-H and Girl Scouts and other after-school groups, but it can be just a homeschooler. Anyone can really enter. And you go to our website, which is kidsciencechallenge.com. KidScienceChallenge.com. And you'll see there's a wealth of information there about the three subjects that you just mentioned. And you'll see, you'll learn what bio-inspired designs are, how there are many things in nature that we take for granted. Velcro, for one, is a popular example that comes actually from an idea that was inspired by something in nature, in this case, a seed burr that got stuck to somebody's sock. And you can come up with an idea for a sport on Mars, taking into account that Mars has very different conditions than Earth does. In particular, its air pressure is kind of low and the gravity is low, and so the sport has to work on Mars. And then come up with an idea for a mystery that you make up, either a real-life or a made-up mystery, using the forensic techniques, the detective science techniques that you would learn on our site. And you'd learn about Mars on our site, and you'd learn about all of these, what bio-inspired design means. You come up with an idea, you get your parental permission is, of course, required, and you can enter online, and you can enter by faxing it or mailing it in. And you can, and then the first, the one of the cool things is the first 1,000 kids who enter get a free, and the whole thing is free, by the way. I should have mm-hmm. said that right off the bat. It's all free. And the first 1,000 kids who enter get a free, wonderful science activity kit as well.
Wow. So there's a lot of free stuff going on there. will kids get help with these ideas? Are they allowed to ask for help?
Well, yeah. There are a couple of ways that they can. One way is they can actually ask the scientists themselves. We have a partner. They'll see the pathway to the partner right on our site. It's called Woogie World. And through their help, kids can actually ask questions of the scientists. And the thing that kind of blew my mind, and we're in the second year of the competition, Ira, we did it last year, and we had a wonderful response. This year, with this new partner, we had, in 1 week, in less than a week, actually, we had 1,000 kids asking questions to our scientists, which was a real surprise to us. We did not expect that many kids to be asking questions, which is a wonderful surprise, but we were scrambling a bit to get all the responses to that, I can assure you. So that's one way. And the scientists do respond, and so, you know, the questions run the gamut.
Yeah. Well, what happens when they get chosen? If they get their idea gets chosen?
Well, that's the coolest thing about the kid science. We have prizes too. But the coolest prize is that you get to collaborate with the scientists. You get the all expense paid trip to collaborate with the scientist and see your idea become real. So last year, for example, we had a skateboard competition. Some young lady who won designed the skateboard, got to visit the skateboard engineers, and actually got to make the skateboard that she had dreamed up.
Wow.
And then they get prizes on top of that. For Sports on Mars, it's a trip to space camp. For the bioengineered designs, it's a behind-the-scenes trip to the San Diego Zoo. And for the detective science, it's a Pali adventure camp, week at an adventure camp.
So these don't have to be really elaborate science fair, geeky sort of things.
Well, this is a competition for the kids who aren't in the fold, the non-science. You know, if you're a true blue science believer, by all means, we'd love to have you. But, for example, a lot of our winners last year were not the real science geeks, per se. They just came up with a great idea. It's Lindsay Carnes, a young lady I was just mentioning about, not only wasn't a quote-unquote science kid, but she'd never been on a skateboard in her life. She just happened to come up with a terrific idea.
There was another one. There was another one I read about that was about an interesting tongue depressor.
Yeah, last year we had a flavor science category, and some kids, they were a team, and they called it, the teams all named themselves, and they called themselves the Candy Doctors. They're from Virginia Beach, Virginia, and they came up with a fabulous idea to, when you go to the doctor, you, instead of having it be a wooden thing you stick in your mouth, why not have it be a candy-flavored tongue depressor? And they did. They got to go to, in this case, Cadbury Chocolates. The scientist was the chief flavorist at Cadbury, and they made their prototype tongue depressor.
Wow. I'm not sure why throw out a wooden stick if you can go home with something to eat instead of the lollipop, you get the tongue depressor.
That's what the candy doctor said, and they were right. And it was, sure, it's actually a fabulous idea. And also, to answer your question before as to what helped, there's lots of downloadable activities. Even if you don't want to enter the competition, which is fine, you can learn about these things, and you can do, we have great downloadable activities and lots of videos and games, and they're all instructive, so you learn viscerally what this subject is about. And then if you want to enter the competition, great, we'd love to have it. And then the kids can send in drawings. We put the drawings up in the gallery, and then the kids get to vote themselves. Even after the competition is over, we have Kids' Choice Awards where the kids vote for what they think is the coolest idea.
And how long, when does the competition end, when the entry period end? How long do they have for that?
Well, the kids have from now, which started on October 1st, and we still have plenty of active, people are entering for sure, but there's still plenty of kits left, don't worry. And it goes until February 28th, the end of February 2010. So you've got some time to think one up. And you mentioned science fairs. We think it's a great opportunity for kids to not only come up with an idea for us, but then use that idea as a springboard for a science fair project. And then we welcome the kids to send in their science fair projects, and we'll put those pictures of their science fair projects up on our website, too.
Well, good luck to you, Jim, and good luck to all the kids out there who are listening. I hope you get 2,000 entries this week.
Ira, thanks. It's kidsciencechallenge.com, and we welcome to receive entries from your listeners.
You're welcome. Jim Metzner, executive producer of the Kids Science Challenge, and you know him from Pulse of the Planet. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today, as always, from NPR librarian Kim Oleski. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we're podcasting and folks still hanging out in Second Life all week and blogging and Twittering and tweeting. Also, if you're in New York, I'll be interviewing Eric Kandel at the New School. He is a Nobel Prize-winning neurologist. We'll talk about his life at the New School over there. And you can click on the face-to-face, Science Face-to-Face, on our website. Go to sciencefriday.com for details on that. And a live podcast, a live webcast, video webcast that you can watch. Have a great week. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
School meals have never won any awards for being healthy. Now, the Institute of Medicine, which advises Congress, is announcing recommendations that include limits on salt, fat, and calories. NPR's Patty Naiman reports.
Many school districts are trying to improve their breakfast and lunch menus with nutritious foods like oatmeal, turkey sandwiches, yogurt parfaits, and salad bars. But many menus still include things like fish sticks, nachos, pasta, and French fries. Now the Institute of Medicine says school menus should take another step forward and reflect more of what's been learned over the past decades about health and nutrition. Pediatrician Virginia Stallings headed the committee.
Using whole grains means the foods are less refined and they retain some of the natural vitamins and minerals and dietary fiber. Which is a particularly hard thing to get in children's diets. So by going to whole grain-rich products, we'll improve some of the nutritional intake and also the fiber intake.
So the recommendations say half of all grains served, that includes breads, muffins, and hamburger buns, should be whole grains. They also want to gradually decrease the amount of salt.
If you look at the sodium intake in the high school school lunch, currently it's about 1,600 milligrams. Over this period, we'd like to get that down to 740 milligrams per meal. So you can see that's more than a half reduction.
Schools that adopt the guidelines would limit trans fats and use low or non-fat milk products. Juice would no longer be counted as a fruit. Only whole fruits would count. And for the first time, there'd be a limit on calories per meal. It used to be that the goal of school nutrition was adequate nourishment. Now there's worry about obesity.
One of the choices will not always be French fries or always be corn, because those are only going to appear on the menu cycle every now and again.
It's all good, says Barry Sacken, a health consultant who's worked in the school food service field for over 30 years. The problem he sees is paying for it. Fresh items can be more expensive, says Sacken, especially in colder regions.
I live in Southern California. Access to fruits and vegetables, particularly fresh, almost year-round is much easier. Trying to find locally sourced fresh produce in the upper Midwest in the middle of January is virtually impossible.
The Institute of Medicine Committee estimates changes to make school menus more nutritious could cost 4% more for lunch and 18% more for breakfast. There are federal subsidies for lower-income children, but those subsidies are the same nationwide, and except for Hawaii and Alaska, they don't take into account regional differences in the cost of food. The recommendations will now be considered by the USDA, which oversees the nation's school lunch program, and Congress will ultimately decide whether to increase funding and adopt these changes. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
Earlier this week, Professor Oliver Williamson, University of California at Berkeley, won the Nobel Prize in Economics. Since then, he's been showered with congratulations from his colleagues and students, and the university will award him an additional, maybe more unique prize. Cyrus Farivar reports from Berkeley.
Winning a Nobel Prize is rare enough, but in this historic university campus, there might be something even more rare. A free parking space on the central campus. These are highly coveted spaces and normally cost about $1,500 per year. So as an added perk, UC Berkeley gives its Nobel laureates a free lifetime parking permit in a special, centrally located, Nobel laureate-only parking area. Professor Oliver Williamson is now the 8th Nobel laureate on the current faculty.
Oh, I plan to receive a copy of parking permit and put it to good use.
There are 5 parking spaces in a row between the physics and economics buildings and another 2 behind the chemistry building, reflecting the various departments currently represented. They're marked with a special sign that reads, "Reserved for NL, Special Permit Required at All Times." That NL, of course, stands for Nobel Laureate. Physics professor George Smoot, who won the prize in 2006, says that although the permit is free, it's not automatically renewed. That's why not all 8 of Berkeley's Nobel laureates have spots.
It's a temporary permit. You got to renew it every year, like your Nobel laureate's going to go away or something. And so twice now I've gotten tickets because I didn't remember to renew it on time.
But a little paperwork's not going to stop Professor Williamson.
I think it ought to be automated, but apply if I must, apply I will.
When I spoke with Professor Williamson earlier this week, he said he's not exactly sure when he'll get the permit. That being said, he'd kind of like to get it quickly.
There's a banquet tonight that the chancellor is putting on, and I'm hoping that he has in his pocket this parking pass, but we'll see.
So you're kind of gunning for it as soon as possible?
I'm hoping for it. I won't be disappointed if I have to struggle for the next 6 weeks without it.
Professor Williamson did not actually receive the permit at the chancellor's dinner, but Professor Williamson did tell me that after speaking with the chancellor about our interview, the chancellor produced a handwritten temporary parking permit on the spot. In the meantime, the the campus parking and transportation officials are working feverishly to set up Professor Williamson's space near his office. He'll collect his Nobel Prize in Stockholm on December 10th. For NPR News, I'm Cyrus Farivar, Berkeley, California.
This is NPR News.